Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Three attorneys general, including those from New York and Massachusetts, held a press call early this week to announce their lawsuit against the Trump administration for rolling back protections under the Affordable Care Act. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
New York Attorney General Letitia James is leading a coalition of 23 attorneys general in filing a lawsuit aimed at stopping a new Trump administration rule she says makes it easier for health care providers and insurance companies to discriminate. James, a Democrat, says this is the latest in a long line of lawsuits New York has filed against the administration for its efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, or ACA.
The Trump administration is trying to discriminate against Americans, specifically the LGBTQ plus community, those with limited English proficiency, and women, amongst so many others. That's why today we are taking legal action once again.
The legal action targets a rule the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, finalized in June, which, according to James, rolls back protections.
This president is unlawfully giving health care providers and insurers license to deny care to LGBTQ plus individuals, those who do not speak English, and women. It is never acceptable to deny health care to Americans who need it, but it is especially egregious to do so in the middle of a pandemic. We have no doubt that this rule was simply motivated by the Trump administration's animus towards the transgender community.
And she contends that HHS has failed to justify why it abandoned its prior policy. According to HHS, the rule maintains enforcement of federal civil rights laws on the basis of race, color, national origin, disability, age, and sex, and restores the rule of law by revising certain provisions that go beyond the plain meaning of the law as enacted by Congress. The department also writes that the final rule will relieve $2.9 billion in unnecessary regulatory burdens over 5 years by eliminating the mandate for regulated entities to send patients and customers inserts in 15 or more foreign languages in most healthcare mailings. HHS says these costs are passed down to patients and consumers. Maura Healey is Massachusetts Attorney General.
So instead of expanding access to care, this White House is once again putting up barriers and exacerbating the fear and anxiety that already exists for these communities.
The Democrat describes the new HHS rule as particularly galling given a recent Supreme Court ruling which held that discrimination based on sexual orientation and transgender status are forms of sex discrimination prohibited by federal civil rights law.
We're asking today to put a stop to this discriminatory rule, to put an end to these indefensible attacks on our communities, and to protect the health care of millions of Americans, particularly during a global pandemic, a pandemic that has already exacerbated disparities in health care and disproportionately impacted our Black, Brown, immigrant, and low-income communities.
Attorneys General in Connecticut, Maine, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Vermont are some of the others who have joined the suit. James describes how the new rule would impact New Yorkers.
Approximately 5% of the population in New York State identify as LGBTQ+, and many members of this community still face widespread discrimination in healthcare settings.
Before the rule was finalized, James and others had called on the Trump administration to withdraw the rule. California Attorney General Javier Becerra joined James and Healey on the call.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, you sat down with Governor Andrew Cuomo again for another conversation. You talked to him about New York City in troubling times. He said that it is very troubling times for the city amid a surge in gun violence and an uptick in graffiti, but he told you that he doesn't need any federal involvement from President Donald Trump.
Well, yes, and he talked to me about how he got on the phone with Trump and told him not to come in, and then Trump agreed. It's interesting because Cuomo has this strange relationship, largely adversarial, and it has been in the past with the mayor. And when things get rough in New York City, there is not so veiled a threat from Cuomo to de Blasio. If you can't handle it, I will. And I have a feeling that the friend of my enemy, if you know what I mean, from the president to Cuomo is pretty good. You know, in other words, okay, you can do it. I don't like de Blasio, and I'll say we'll stay out of New York State because of what you are saying. And we've seen Cuomo do it. He has, in fact, moved to say to de Blasio, you've got to stop this, and to the police in New York City, or we'll come in. And, you know, it's not so veiled a threat, and it has been effective. And I think the confluence of political interests may have been at work here.
Alan, you also spoke with Governor Cuomo about the schools, K through 12 specifically, and what's going to happen in the fall. He says a decision will come in early August. There's a lot of pushback on this with the virus growing around the country and worries that it will grow again in New York. There's an interesting column in the Times that sort of sums up what we've known about not only New York, but schools in general, the inequities that are in the poor and the rich areas of the state. Privileged kids get private learning pods. Everyone else suffers. What are we going to do with the schools?
Well, David, first of all, let's get to the crucial point. Are we going to reopen the schools in New York State? Right now, our numbers of infection are very low. And I asked the governor specifically, if that keeps up, so that means I assume that the schools are going to open. And he didn't say no, that's for sure. He said, we'll have to see. We'll follow the science. We'll follow the numbers. But he's also in a positive mood because our numbers are quite good in New York State. Good enough so that if they keep up, schools will open.
How are you going to pay for all that? You're going to need nurses and stations and distancing and separate buildings and all of that. And many of the school officials are saying that's going to cost, you know, millions of dollars. And as the governor told you, the state is broke.
State is broke, $16 billion in the hole and just in the regular budget problems. You know, when this kind of pressure gets put on, somehow we make out. Somehow money is diverted from one place into another. And that can hurt a great deal, because there are programs that depend on this money. But then you start to prioritize. You say, what's more important, our school children, David, or something that is less in the moment? And so I suspect there's going to be a lot of hurt out there.
How far they've fallen, Alan. Former New York State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver will finally go to prison for his crimes, but not for another month. A judge ruled Monday as she sentenced the former Assembly Speaker to 6.5 years in federal prison, nearly 5 years after he was first convicted of corruption.
That's as close to a death sentence as you'll find. Obviously, he's a man upper age, and 6 years puts him into his 80s. And even if he gets out a little early, that's something. Now, I suspect they're going to try to find an appeal to this, too. The facts of the matter seem pretty plain to me. I knew him. He would be on our Capital Connection show with some regularity. But you can't be a wise guy. You just can't think that you're bigger than the system. If you're a public official, you better run scared all the time and not do anything, anything that would seem askance.
Will Barkley, the Assembly Minority Leader, the Republican who you've spoken with, who, when you asked him if he's spoken to the governor, said, staff speak, and I'm not sure that he would take my call. Well, you asked the governor if he'd take the call.
Well, I asked him. I told him I was going to ask him, and I asked him on the air, will you take Will Barkley's call? And he could not have been more gracious. He knew his father. His father was a great politician, Will Barkley's father. And he said, we're going to go fishing together. And sure, I'll take his call. What was he going to say? No, I won't take his call.
But it does highlight, you know, you often talk about the minority in the assembly and
the lack of power.
So why pay attention to him is often the thought.
I always say Republicans in the New York State Assembly have the power of warm spit. And they do.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Governor Andrew Cuomo says 10 states have been added to New York's quarantine list and 4 bars have been ordered closed in an attempt to keep the coronavirus from spreading again in the state. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The 10 states where travelers into New York are subject to a mandatory quarantine include Virginia, North Dakota, and Alaska, bringing the total to 31 states. Florida, Texas, and California are already on the list. Governor Cuomo says he's looking at whether to add the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico to the quarantine regulations as the virus spikes there. New York is home to the most Puerto Ricans in the United States outside of the island, and the governor has been very supportive of Puerto Rico, traveling there frequently to help after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. But Cuomo says it's not about playing favorites.
We look at the numbers, we follow the science. It's not that, you know, the states who are on the list or off the list, there's no like or dislike of favorite state or unfavorite state. It's just a function of math.
The state of Minnesota has been taken off the quarantine list as the number of infections continues to decline there. The governor also announced that 4 bars on Long Island and in Queens have had their liquor licenses suspended for violating COVID-19 safety rules and allowing large groups to congregate. The governor continues to express worries that bars who are violating social distancing rules will lead to an uptick in the spread of the disease. He says the drinking establishments are taking advantage of a loophole in New York's laws. The state liquor authority issues just one type of license to bars and restaurants, and he says reopening rules allowed for outdoor dining, but not for outdoor bar service.
They were never supposed to institute outdoor drinking. It was outdoor dining. The words are outdoor dining. They took outdoor dining and used it as an opportunity to do outdoor drinking. That is not what the regulations permitted. And, well, the governor's changing the rules. No, I'm not changing the rules. They exploited the existing regulation.
For now, though, the governor has not followed through with a threat to rescind all outdoor dining. The announcements come on a day that deaths from coronavirus reached what the governor says is a significant milestone, with just 2 New Yorkers dying from the disease on Monday.
Obviously, that's 2 too many. But remember, at one time we had over 800 deaths in a single day.
724 remain hospitalized with the virus, and the rate of transmission is at 1.2%. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
State travel restrictions and the closure of the U.S.-Canadian border during the coronavirus pandemic has put severe stresses on northern New York's tourism industry. New York's 21st Congressional District spans the state's northern region and straddles the border from Watertown to Lake Champlain. Representative Elise Stefanik recently held a virtual roundtable to discuss the pandemic's impact and update industry leaders on remedial actions in Washington. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik invited business owners, tourism advocacy organizations, and elected leaders from across the district to discuss the needs of the tourism industry as the COVID-19 pandemic strangles travel.
The purpose is to allow us to listen as representatives, whether it's at the federal or state level, to your top concerns, and also for us to provide an update to you as to what issues we are working on related to tourism and the important seasonal economy across the North Country and the Adirondacks.
Stefanik highlighted some of the key federal actions that could impact the regional tourism economy.
I co-chair the bipartisan Northern Border Caucus. We are advocating for a comprehensive plan to provide certainty and a timeline to reopen the northern border. In addition, many businesses have raised the issue of the additional pandemic unemployment assistance. One of the top concerns that I've heard from the business community is that it has hindered their ability to hire back workers. And the last issue I wanted to highlight is I'm advocating that our chambers, as well as our tourist offices, are able to apply for the Paycheck Protection Program.
A number of chamber leaders and business owners discussed their concerns, and one common theme surfaced. Six Flags Great Escape President Rebecca Woods says clearer communication with government is the biggest challenge they face.
First and foremost, we really need to get clearer communication. Where do we fall in these phases? Outdoor attractions, And we just have absolutely no idea right now where we stand. Like I said, we just need an answer. And we just don't have them right now, I think, is our biggest challenge.
Washington County Fair Manager Rebecca Breeze says the cancellation of the fair this year will not only have an economic impact on the community, but result in losses for groups like churches, youth, and firemen's organizations that rely on fairs for income. Breeze agrees that a lack of communication is the biggest problem.
We do have an open-air property, a property that has a lot of space for social distancing. And we have events that are small that we would like to pursue, but the lack of clarity from the government is really making it quite tricky for us. And I think that's true for all agritourism. You know, we're being told 33% capacity, but we're not really being told on how we're supposed to calculate that. So it causes a lot of pause when we're looking at, you know, being able to host events that could maybe help us make the difference to make it to next year.
Yvonne Nichols, co-owner of Boots and Birdies Mini Golf in Lake Placid, says other than her business solvency, the key issue she faces is lack of communication with officials.
There needs to be open communication with the owners of these businesses to say, hey, this is how we're doing it, and this is how we're doing it safely. To have just a bunch of, you know, the elected officials just, you know, sitting together and making the rules without actually talking to the business owners, I think that there's a huge loss. And being seasonal, it's a time frame that we can't get back. Every day lost is huge for everybody. So, you know, I'm hoping that there can be, you know, some sort of bailout for the very small business owners that are taking this hit.
Other topics discussed by the travel and tourism operators included the need for additional Paycheck Protection Program funding and the need for staffing and incentives for people to return to work. Congress is expected to return to Washington on Monday to discuss more federal aid.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A new survey finds the number of New Yorkers touched by opioid abuse is rising. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
Consumer confidence in upstate New York has bounced back slightly in June after tanking in April. According to a poll released Wednesday by the Siena College Research Institute, the New York State Index of Consumer Sentiment in the second quarter of 2020 stands at 71%, up 4.6 points from the last measurement in the first quarter of 2020. Siena pollster Doug Lundstrom.
These are very horrible times for everybody. But in general, a little bit of good news compared to the bad news. For instance, if we look, New York State is up roughly about 5 points in consumer sentiment, while the nation was down 11. So we closed the gap a substantial amount. So we're looking a heck of a lot better. We're still behind the nation, but we're looking better than we did. And the index has two components, current and future. If we look at the current component, New York State was up about 8. The nation was down about 17. And if we look at the future component, New York was up about 2. Nation was down about 7.
Lundstrom says all indices for New York are below their break-even points, at which optimism and pessimism balance for the second consecutive quarter.
New York City did the best. Upstate's kind of flat, frankly, and New York City was up about 8 points. So the increase in the state came from New York City. It did not come from upstate.
Lundstrom adds second quarter buying plans for things like vehicles, furniture, consumer electronics, and new homes are all up slightly from the first quarter, while concern about gas prices is at its lowest percentage in the 12 years Siena has been tracking the impact of gas prices on New York consumers.
It's down to 25% because nobody's going anywhere, so they're not buying any gas. If we go back a year ago, it was 44%. We're concerned about gas prices.
Lundstrom notes 58%, up from 55%, of state residents say the amount of money they spend on groceries is having either a very serious or somewhat serious impact on their finances. Ward Todd, president and CEO of the Ulster County Regional Chamber of Commerce, says while some businesses have been struggling and are fearful for the rest of the year if things don't open up, others have weathered the pandemic rather well.
Things were closed from mid-March all the way, for the most part, through a good part of May. When June hit, there seemed to have been a real pent-up need or desire to get out and spend. Most of our restaurants, I think partly fueled by a Facebook group we started called Ulster Eateries United, many of them saw lots of people doing takeout and delivery and outside dining as well. But a number of businesses have really seen June be a great month and have told us anecdotally that July has started off strong as well. So it really has to do with how long can this good stretch of business continue for many of them, but preliminarily, it has been a good last 45 days or so for many businesses locally.
But the Siena poll finds, despite reopening, most people say they are worse off and expect the economy to weaken. Again, Lundstrom.
Looking forward, people are not as optimistic as they were, you know, before the virus.
There's a link to the survey at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Back with us on the Legislative Gazette this week is Dr. Lynn Porodnik, medical marijuana doctor from Westchester County area in New York. She's helped us understand what the rules are, how medical marijuana works in the state, how other states have been developing their programs, including issues like making sure that those who have the least are also included in what would be a profit-making business for New York State should it become legal at some point. Dr. Lynn Porodnik, welcome back.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. I know we want to start today with quite an interesting story. And if you think about it, with those folks having medical marijuana cards, the ability to purchase medical marijuana for whatever condition they might have that qualifies, sort of see it as their medicine that they can take with them wherever they go. But wait a minute, what happens when you cross over the line, the border, for example, into Mexico? And you have a story of one of your patients who experienced a little trouble when they did that.
Oh, let's call it a lot of trouble. I have a 50-year-old female who's a cancer survivor. She had a bilateral mastectomy. She's got nothing on top. She goes to Mexico once a year for vacation, and she decided what a great way to spend some time during COVID. So she was out on her way to a ferry to go to Isla Mujeres, and she stopped to smoke her pre-rolled joint that she used her New York ground bud with. And she, 5 minutes later, the federales came and arrested her. They stole her jewelry, stole her money, and put her in jail. She got a lawyer in Mexico who agreed to take the case on for $450. So she spent two nights in jail, was finally released, gets back to the hotel, and the lawyer wants to know when is she leaving. She told the lawyer, oh, Friday, but actually had plans to leave on Tuesday just to get out. And then the lawyer started trying to exploit her. She said the original fees change. This is much more complicated. She needs to get together $5,000 before she leaves the country. My patient said, you know, that's a lot of money for me. It's much more than I was planning to spend on this vacation. And the lawyer said, well, if you want to go home, that's the price you're going to have to pay. Then the lawyer called back the next day and said, nope, the fee is $10,000 or you're going back to jail. So my patient decided, you know what? I'm getting out of here, got the next plane out, and is back in Westchester, never to go back to Cancun again. It seems that part of the problem is that during COVID, they don't have as many tourists as usual. So the police are used to picking up drunk kids, kids doing drugs, and they're able to get money out of them, and now the funds have dried out. So they're going after older people smoking pot. And, boy, this woman, after a few nights in jail, just really decided she's not going anywhere for a very long time. This is her medicine. This is what she needs to survive. And in all places, in her mind, Mexico would be, what kind of issue is that? They have all these cartels. This is kind of part of the life. She didn't really think it through. We never discussed international travel, but she learned very quickly.
It's always a good idea anyway to check the State Department to see what warnings might be out there if you're going to travel to another country. You know, just because you have an ability to do it in your home state doesn't mean you can do it in other countries.
Exactly. I always tell patients if they're traveling, have a friend call the embassy and find out what is the policy of this specific country. Then they can make an intelligent decision about how to proceed.
Dr. Lynn Porodnik, medical marijuana doctor in New York. I'm David Gustina. That about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2030. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.